So before we begin with the study of Torah this morning, this is, as you may know, depending on how attuned you are to these things, this is really an extraordinary day in history. This is the 200th anniversary of the birthday of two most important men in modern history, Charles Darwin and Abraham Lincoln. Both of them were born on this day 200 years ago. And they represent, obviously, very different parts of modernity. One of them represents the ability of human beings to understand their own origins and the world around them. That's Darwin. And Lincoln represents the ability of human beings to transcend their own passions and hates and maintain the great experiment in democracy that America has become, and also the ability of this country to withstand what was by far its greatest crisis. Remember that America has the almost unique advantage of a country that has been to war many times of never having been invaded, right? I mean, the mainland of America, except for the American Revolution, really has been unscathed with the exception of the Civil War. And so even though in California and in the Northeast, the Civil War is more about history, if you go to the South of America, for example, it's a living reality that is still very much part of the history of this country. And therefore, since this is the 200th anniversary of both, and I'm going to talk about Darwin this Shabbos and Lincoln, but I thought that we ought to start before we begin studying with those less than 300 words that constitute the greatest single speech of American history, and that, of course, is the Gettysburg Address. And this is what Lincoln said. It wasn't really written on the back of an envelope, but nonetheless, this is what Lincoln said at Gettysburg, which was a central battlefield, of course, of the Civil War. And it's so familiar to us that we tend not to hear how brilliant the words are, but I hope you can hear them anew. 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we're engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation, or any nation so conceived and so dedicated, can long endure. We're met on a great battlefield of that war. We've come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this. But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead, we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. Okay. Oh, there's so much stuff on Lincoln. There are more books written on Lincoln than anyone, with the possible exception of Jesus and Napoleon. That's how great the fascination that Lincoln is. Still, by the way, I've only read a tiny, tiny fraction of what is available, but of everything I've read, still the best one-volume biography is David Herbert Donald's, which was written in 1995. So if you're looking for one biography of Lincoln, that's the one to go to, David Herbert Donald, and it's just called Lincoln. There are many good ones, but the reason that I say this is because a whole batch came out this year, and I read the reviews of many of them, and several of the reviews said, of course, the best single-volume biography remains this one, which was published in 95. I often look for reviews to see what other books they recommend apart from the book they're reviewing. So, what's that? The Doris Kearns Goode one is not a biography of Lincoln. It's very good. Team of Rivals, it's called. It's about Lincoln's cabinet and how he governed, but it's not actually about all of Lincoln's life. And it's very popular these days because of the connection to Obama and Obama's governing philosophy. But if you want a biography of Lincoln, his childhood, his early friends, his everything about him, then Donald is the way to go. Doris Kearns Goodwin always writes very readable and engaging books. So you can't go wrong with one of her books either. All right. Yes, back to the Bible, from which, by the way, Lincoln took many of his rhetorical cadences. He was a great devoted reader of the Bible. So there you go. All right. We are now post-switch. That is Rachel and Leah. And let's go to verse 31, just to remind ourselves where we are. Jacob has married now Rachel and Leah, intending only to marry Rachel, but there was a sale that day, and and he got both. So now he has to try to build a family. The Lord saw that Leah was unloved, and he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. Leah conceived and bore a son and named him Reuven, I've seen a son, or I've seen my sorrow. Benoni later will be what Rachel wants to call her child, who she conceives as she dies, the son of my sorrow. But actually, Jacob ends up renaming him Benjamin, the son of my right hand. For she declared, it means the Lord has seen my affliction, and it also means now my husband will love me. Okay, a sad line, because that's doesn't happen, and I'll come back to that in a minute. She conceived again and bore a son and declared, this is because the Lord heard I was unloved and has given me this one also. She named him Shimon. Again, she conceived and bore a son and declared, this time my husband will become attached to me, for I've borne him three sons. Therefore, he was named Levi, or Levi. She conceived again and bore a son and said, this time I will praise the Lord. Therefore, she named him Judah. Then she stopped bearing. Now, Judah's significance in Jewish history is what? He becomes the forerunner of the Messiah, right? The Messiah comes from the house of Judah. David comes from the house of Judah. The southern kingdom is named Judah. The northern kingdom is named Israel. The southern kingdom is named Judah. Judah's origin, therefore, is interesting. Notice the difference between what Leah says about Judah and what she says about her first three sons. The first three sons are all about making her husband love her. Judah is about praising God. Okay? So at a certain now, there are lots of ways you can look at this. One of the ways you can look at it is that it's sad she finally realizes that having children won't compel her husband's love. On the other hand, there's another way to look at it, which I will come to in just a second. In fact, let's read a couple of lines and then I'll come to it. When Rachel saw that she'd borne Jacob no children, she became envious of her sister. Rachel said to Jacob, give me children or I shall die. Jacob was incensed at Rachel and said, can I take the place of God who's denied you the fruit of the womb? Now, you can understand Rachel's upset. Right? Jacob loves her, and yet she can't bear children, and Leah is bearing child after child, not just child after child, but son after son, exactly. So the question that we're going to deal with today is Rachel's comment and Jacob's answer. Jacob's answer seems extraordinarily insensitive, right? Can I take the place of God who's denied you the fruit of the womb? Instead of saying, I feel so bad for you, honey, of course I'll pray for you, I don't know, can I rub your feet? Something that would indicate that he has some human feeling for Rachel's disappointment, because her disappointment is grave, obviously, that she doesn't. So this is a, as you might imagine, this is a much discussed issue, but the answer I want to turn to first, is the quite beautiful answer that I used in one of the off the pulpits actually about a year ago. And if you don't receive off the pulpit, just call my office, be happy to send it to you. And that's from the Akedat Yitzchak. The Akedat Yitzchak, the Binding of Isaac, it was written by Rabbi Yitzchak Arama in the 16th century. Now, The reason it's called the Akedat Yitzchak is that people name their books usually after some part of the Torah or some passage in the Torah. So since his name was Yitzchak, Isaac, he called his book the Akedat Yitzchak. Okay, and it's interesting, by the way, that in the Jewish tradition, people are often known by their books. People will call him the Akedat Yitzchak instead of calling him Isaac Arama, which is it's a very interesting thing. It's one of the parts of this is that also there are almost no biographies of Jews in the Middle Ages. People didn't write about themselves. And they become their books, which are often very separate from their, you know, legal codes. Sometimes Maimonides will be called the Mishneh Torah, which is just his legal code. But Isaac Arama, now, remember that we're talking about the 16th century, okay? Like, a long time ago in terms of social attitudes. Let's just say that. And this is what he writes. The two names woman, Isha and Chava, okay? Isha is woman, but Chava, Eve, is Eim Kol Chai, the mother of everything that lives, right? That's the etymology of Eve's name, right? Chava, Chai. Indicate two purposes. The first, Isha, teaches that woman was taken from man. Ish, Isha, right? Stressing that like a man, you may understand and advance in the intellectual and moral fields just as did the matriarchs and many righteous women and prophetesses, as the literal meaning of Proverbs 31, Eshet Chayil, indicates. In other words, the woman's first name, Isha, shows that she has the same task in this world as a man to advance morally and intellectually. Okay? You with him so far? The second, Chava, alludes to the power of childbearing and rearing children, as is indicated by the name Eve, mother of all living. A woman deprived of the power of childbearing will be deprived of her secondary purpose and be left with the ability to do evil or good like the man who is barren. Of both barren men and women, Isaiah says, I have given them in my house and in my walls a name that is better than sons and daughters. In other words, your primary responsibility as a human being is to grow as a human being. Women have the additional ability to raise children that men don't. Jacob was therefore angry with Rachel when she said, give me children or else I die, in order to reprimand her and make her understand this all-important principle, that she was not dead as far as their joint purpose in life because she was childless, just the same as it would be in his case if he would have been childless. This is the 16th century we're talking about. That's an extraordinary comment for someone to make, you know, 500 years ago, that in fact what Rachel has is an additional opportunity to do that above Jacob, but that's not the primary purpose of her being alive any more than the primary purpose of his being alive. And that's why he was upset with her. Now, we're going to look at other reasons to be upset. But the reason that I bring this up is that you can also, to some extent, apply it to Leah. For the first three children, she thought, my job is to get my husband to love me by having children. But then, to some extent, it seems like she realizes, no, I'm having a child for the greater glory of God and not so that my husband will love me. And you know, just speaking about it from the point of view of a modern family, the idea that your children are being used, in order to get your spouse to love you is that's not a formula that's going to produce happy children, right? That was the first of the responses I wanted to give, because I thought that it was really, really an extraordinary and a beautiful response. But now I want to give you some other examples of the way in which people answer this question. So this one is from Ramban, okay, Nachmanides. So it was inconceivable. This is one of the answers he gives. He gives a few, but this one I think is interesting. That Jacob had not prayed on behalf of his favorite wife because she was barren. That makes sense. You can't actually imagine that Jacob hadn't already prayed to God, right? He obviously, first of all, he wants to have children. Second, he loves Rachel. Third, he had to see how miserable Rachel was. And not only would he pray on her behalf, but he'd pray on his own behalf, right? Because what makes you more miserable than a miserable spouse? Seriously, you know? And how many good wishes on behalf of our spouses are on our own behalf? I really hope this works out for her. I really, really do. Because if it doesn't, she's going to be so unhappy. I mean, you know, it's true on both sides. That's the person you live with is easier to live with if they're happy, unless you detest them, right? And then their happiness gets on your nerves. But if you live with somebody you like, their happiness makes your life infinitely easier and better. So of course Jacob is going to pray. I mean, that's not what Ramban said. Ramban doesn't make that cynical. That was just me. Doesn't make that cynical remark. But of course you're going to pray that your spouse is happy. What possible percentage is there in not praying? So he assumes that Jacob prayed and that Rachel would know that he prayed. So we must conclude, therefore, that his prayer had not been answered. It's not that Jacob didn't pray, but that, as often happens, he prayed for something that he wasn't granted. Rachel came along and upbraided him for doing nothing, asking him at least to bring her children through his prayers, since he was no way inferior to his father Isaac, who had done so, right, who had prayed and had children with the woman that he loved. Whereupon Jacob became angry and told her that the matter lay in God's hands and not his. As for his father, his prayer was answered because he was a righteous man and destined to have seed, whereas in her case it was from her that the fruit of the womb was withheld. That is the true interpretation. Now, there are three different interpretations in here, okay? One is he prayed and he wasn't answered. The second is that he was angry, and you notice that Ramban brings up his father. So maybe he's angry because he feels like she was comparing him to his father who got children and he didn't. And then the third is the harshest interpretation, which is Jacob is saying to her, look, I prayed and I had children with Leah. You have to pray. This is about you. It's not about me. Right? And this, Ramban only hints at it. He doesn't say it explicitly for reasons. I mean, obviously, you don't want to say that. But again, if you're reading this, I mean, most of the commentators, one of the things that makes rabbinic comments interesting about such stuff is, of course, rabbis have always been married. You're not reading the speculations of celibate people about what marriage is like. So Ramban is hinting that Jacob is saying, look, this isn't my fault, right? I already have kids, which he could think of. And now it's true there wasn't polygamy in Ramban's time, but there were lots of people who had second and third marriages, right? A lot of people died young. So they could say, look, I had children with my previous wife, or I had children with my previous husband. If I'm not having children now, and also I think that Ramban's sense is that Jacob's anger comes less from, there are two reasons why Jacob could be angry in terms of his sense of himself being attacked. One is, why didn't you pray for me? The other is, your prayers aren't good enough. You're not righteous enough. If you were righteous like your father, your prayers would work. So if that second is what Jacob is hearing, his answer is, my prayers do work. I have kids with Leah. My prayers aren't working with you, so maybe there's something going on with you that we need to look at. You can imagine how this conversation went down. But the nicest interpretation of this is one that Leibovitz puts on it. He was concerned with the misleading approach to prayer evident in her words, her incomprehension of the real relation between man and God. Ramban explains that the worshiper who sincerely desires to be exalted by his sacrifices wishes to draw closer to God, whereas the idolater wishes to bring his level, the supernatural object of his sacrifice, exploiting it for his own ends. In other words, why do you pray? Do you pray to have God do what you want, or do you pray to draw close to God? According to this interpretation, what Jacob is upset about is Rachel has a very utilitarian approach to prayer. Pray, so I get kids. I didn't get kids, so you must not have prayed. And Jacob's saying that's not actually what prayer is about. prayer is drawing close to God. God decides whether you get children or not, but that's actually not why you pray. I'm not in God's place. I don't make these decisions. I can pray and draw close to God without without being able necessarily to get you a child. That interpretation, I want to give also from the Talmud. I didn't bring it today. I'm always telling you to bring the book, and I did the Tanakh, and I forgot it. But anyway, there is a verse in the book of Job. Okay, should a wise man make answer with windy knowledge and fill his belly with the east wind? All right. Should a wise man make answer with windy knowledge and fill his belly with the east wind? So Rabbi Alexandri in the Midrash applies the first one to Abraham. Should a wise man make answer with windy knowledge? And he applies that to Abraham listening to Sarah. It says Abraham hearkened to the voice of Sarah. And then it says, and fill his belly with the east wind, and Jacob's anger was kindled. In other words, when Abraham answered, he answered with knowledge. When Jacob answered, he answered emptily. Rabbi Alexandri is condemning Jacob. When Sarah says to Abraham, I'm upset, Abraham does what Sarah says. When Rachel says to Jacob, pray to God, he gets angry at her. So one rabbinic interpretation is in fact to condemn Jacob for this and to have the same sense that we did, that Jacob isn't really hearing Sarah and is answering her, I would say thoughtlessly, is the proper way as answering Rachel that way. Jacob also uses the same words, can I take the place of God, that Joseph uses later. When Joseph's brothers come to him and say, you're going to punish us, he says, do I take the place of God? Except that Joseph is using it to comfort them, whereas Jacob is using it to be defensive and angry, which is also another interesting thing. I was going to say that it shows a difference in their character. It may also just show a difference in their age or experience. But nonetheless, the fact is that Joseph answers kindly the same thing that Jacob uses, the phrase kindly that Jacob uses angrily and defensively. And then lastly, there is this is the comment that Alter makes. Give me sons, for if you don't, I'm a dead woman. That's how he translates the verse. And he says, it's a general principle of biblical narrative that a character's first recorded speech has defining force as characterization. In other words, the first thing you say tells you what you're like. The first thing that Abraham says is, Hineni, here I am. That's Abraham all the way, right? The first thing that Rachel says is, give me children or I die. Surprisingly, although Rachel's been part of the story for more than a decade of narrated time, this is the first piece of dialogue assigned to her. This is the first time we hear Rachel's voice. It's a sudden revelation of her simmering frustration and impulsivity, her impulse, right? In fact, she speaks with impetuous reminiscent of her brother-in-law Esau, who also announced to Jacob that he was on the point of death if Jacob didn't immediately give him what he wanted. Remember that? Right, give me those lentils or I'll die. So Jacob is always, not always, but I mean two times in the Bible is always, Jacob's always having people around him who are making demands of him and being melodramatic about it, right? You got to do this or I'm going to die, right? Like teenagers. Also, there is in this a foreshadowing, because not only does Rachel die young, but Rachel dies young in childbirth. So God gives her children and she dies, which is a painfully ironic result of saying, give me children or I'll die. In fact, she dies in childbirth. So there is a great deal going on in this simple phrase. And you should note when she says, she doesn't say, give me children. What does she say? Give me sons. Am I instead of God? Through Jacob's words, the writer shrewdly invokes a faithful deflection of the Annunciation type scene. He's about to explain what that means. According to the Annunciation story, the Annunciation story is the story of the birth of an important, you know, like the story that Moses is born and put in the river is an Annunciation story. The story of some kind of miraculous coming of a child, or the story of the birth of Jacob and Esau, where God says there are two children in your womb, that's an Annunciation story. Usually the barren wife goes to an oracle or is visited by a divine messenger or God to be told she'll give birth. Remember the angels that come to Abraham and say, you're gonna have a child. That's an Annunciation story. A-N. What's that? A-N. Yeah. Announce. A-N. Annunciation. A-N-N-U-C. Rachel instead importunes, that means pleads with, her husband, who properly responds that he can't play God's role in the bestowal of fertility or the Annunciation narrative. Rachel's then forced back on the strategy of surrogacy, like Sarai with Hagar, because the next thing Rachel says is, here, take Bilhah, right? One should note that she demands sons, not a son. She doesn't say, give me a son. She says, give me sons, right? Eventually, she will have two sons, but will die in giving birth to the second. Perhaps her rash words here are meant to foreshadow her premature death. All right, so those are some of the reactions. I want to say a few words about all of them before we. And by the way, the harshest of all midrashim. You know. Well, I'll just tell you what the midrash is. There's a midrash that is, it's a minor midrash that's preserved in Kosher's book, which is a compilation of all the various rabbinic interpretations that says, why did Rachel die young? Because she equated man with God. Which is a sort of species of idolatry. That is, she said to her husband, you have to give me kids or I'll die. As which you can say to God, because God has that power. But Jacob doesn't. But by treating Jacob as God, she was punished with her own death. Okay. Hold on 1 second. Let me finish with everything and then I'll take questions and comments. Okay. So the comment that it opens with in chapter 30, when Rachel saw that she had borne Jacob no children, she became envious of her sister, and Rachel said to Jacob, give me children or I shall die. What strikes me that we don't actually have a comment on here, at least not yet, is that her unhappiness about not having children is occasioned by the fact that her sister did. It doesn't say when Rachel saw that she was barren, she became unhappy and said, give me children or I'll die. And I think there is a lot wrapped up in this. Let's say that Rachel, in fact, is really desperately in love with Jacob as he's in love with her, and they're very happy together. The having of children might not be the first thing that, as a young lover who's trying to set up a house, you know, in her father's house, she would necessarily want. The impulse, actually, for her to want children comes from the fact that Leah keeps having them, which does make sense. Right? It might be that eventually she wants to have children, but that might not be her first impulse in living with Jacob. And it's spurred by the fact that Leah wants to have children, which suggests also that her motivation for having children isn't. When she saw how desperately she loved Jacob, she wished to have his child. And I say this because normally, we read these stories without reflecting on how much of the possibility of what goes on in human relations is hidden here, but it's entirely possible. Maybe Rachel wasn't maternal. Maybe she wasn't the kind of person who would naturally have children. Who knows, right? Or at least wasn't ready to. I mean, she's very young, right? You've got to assume that she's still in her maybe early to mid-teens here, because Leah's her older sister, and Leah had to get married pretty early, too. If she's 14, 15, she was already getting married at a later age than most people did. So, and also remember, life expectancy was a lot less. So people tended to have children in their teens, early 20s. To have children later, which happens sometimes, but to have children later was unusual. So the Sarah, of course, had a child at 99 or 100, but that wasn't so common. So what's that? In vitro, right, exactly. Angelic intervention, which is sort of the same thing. But the fact that it specifically states that she became envious of her sister is an interesting way of introducing the subject. And then the fact that because Jacob says, I can't necessarily produce children, she responds with, here, have kids with Bilhah, also lets us know that what's going on is a domestic power struggle as much as a desire to have children. And there, the usual, and here you have to think about what the power base is for a woman in the ancient world. Right? The primary power base is her two things. One is her influence on her husband, who is public, who has a public power base, and the second is her influence at home, right? In general, and on children. So if Leah has four kids running around the house and she's their mother, that really gives her a much stronger say in what goes on in the world. And for Rachel to have children, even if it's through Bilhah, is a way of evening the score, or trying to even the score. So it's very, and now the last thing we have to think about is, what's God's design in all this? So the generous interpretation here is that God feels sorry for Leah. Rachel is young and impetuous and loved and beautiful, and Leah is married because her father tricked her husband. I mean, just imagine how that must feel for her. And the one thing that can give her something, even if it doesn't give her the love of her husband, can give her love in her life, is children. Because her children will love her even if her husband doesn't love her. And it will also give her a say with her husband, even if it doesn't give her his love. So that may be part of God's design. God doesn't, as far as I can think of in the Torah, there's never a time when God forces someone to love someone else. That, God doesn't do that. But God can give children, and therefore give Leah some compensation for the fact that she's unloved, since he's not going to make Jacob love her. And why he withholds children from Rachel, again, if you follow the same line of reasoning, it's because Rachel already has something and she will have children eventually, but it's not bad for her to feel the frustration that her sister has felt, or some of the disappointment, or some of the anger. And that may be part of what the text also, the one other thing that we should note is, it almost always happens, not always, but almost always happens, that the beloved child is born in the Bible of a woman who has trouble giving birth to children. Right? Barrenness and fullness, just read the book of Ruth, is filled with images of barrenness and fullness. The beloved child comes along later, you have trouble. That's just a very, very common type scene. And the fact that Joseph is going to be the most important child, it's unsurprising that he is also a child who has spent a long time in arrival, right? And Benjamin, too, who are the two children of Rachel, both of them are going to be special, and both of them are born of a barren mother, right? The Psalms are also full of this. Eim habanim smecha. The idea of barrenness and then birth, which starts, by the way, with us, with Sarah, runs all through the Jewish tradition, and certainly all through the biblical tradition. Okay, let's stop there for a minute and take comments. Go ahead. Yes. The Midrash is the rabbinic teachings. The Midrash primarily, the rabbis commented on the Bible a great deal, okay? Some of their comments are legal, some of their comments are what we would call homiletical, that is, legends, filling in gaps, making comments on characters. The Midrash was primarily written in what is now Israel, although a lot of it was written in Babylonia too, over the course of many centuries, almost 1,000 years. It goes back probably to when the Bible was first set, because there's so much of the Bible that's unexplained, and goes to 800-900 CE because there are Midrashim, there are rabbinic Midrashim that show clear Islamic influence, and Islam didn't come into the world till the 7th century. So all of these, and there are vast collections, and Midrash is both a body of literature and an activity. You do Midrash, and you also read Midrashim. So that's what the Midrash is. Yes?
Where do you get fact that Leah and Rachel, therefore, were very young? Where does that
doesn't say it explicitly, but if their marriageable age in the ancient Near East, that marriageable age was 12, right? And sometimes younger, but 12 is when you come into your majority.
Okay, but then right. 7 years have passed, so now they're way into it.
She's 19, so she's 19, and Rachel is what, 13, 14?
Well, do you think that they're 7 years
apart? Oh, easily. 7 years could have gone by, but it's because she had four children. But it's easy for someone to be married at 8, 9, 10. It's not unusual in the ancient Near East. Rachel could have been 11, maybe. I mean, as you know, those of you who are one generation away from Eastern Europe, yes, and also Iran, people were betrothed at 8 years old, 7 years old, got married at 10, 11. Not unusual. So, yeah. Why did he start for Rachel, or he started for
Leah?
Does he start 7? No, it's not. 7 years have passed. 7 years have passed since he got married. He doesn't start 7 years for Leah. This is just 7 years. What Alter says is it's been 7 years in the narration, and Rachel hasn't spoken yet. But he doesn't say. I think Leah started to have kids right away. Right. It says he served him another 7 years, and God saw that Leah was unloved. But I don't think that's intended to be. It was 7 years, and then he opened. I think it was during those 7 years these things happened. Yeah.
Rachel says, "Give me children," and then she uses the word "metai" in the present instead of "tamut" in the future. Could it mean "give me children before I die"?
It would. I think, although I'm not sure, it would be lifnei. I think you'd have to use a lifnei in there. This is the way v'im ein meta anochi. It says, and if not, no, give me children, and if not, I'll die. I don't think that the sentence can hold that construction, although, you know, why not? Maybe she has a premonition of her own mortality. Maybe she thinks that she's going to die young. It's possible. Yeah.
I believe when Rachel says, "Give me children or I will die," perhaps she's referring to an emotional death. She sees herself becoming very envious of Leah, who she loved, and even went as far as allowing Leah to marry Jacob, you know, 7 years ago. And anger can turn into depression, which is an emotional death, and maybe that's why it's referred to in the present.
It could be. I mean, I would say that it's certainly the text can certainly bear that interpretation. Although I think that you don't have to take it literally either way. I don't know that this was a considered statement, "I actually will cease to exist." I mean, how often do we say things like that, right? If this doesn't happen, I'll die.
She will cease to exist because she'll have no children.
No, what I'm saying is I don't think you have to take it as she'll cease to exist. I don't think that she was saying, "I will literally cease to exist." I think this is intended to be hyperbole, and Jacob understands it that way, because if he didn't, I don't think he would have answered, "It's not me," right? Yeah. Left. Well, that's
right.
Right. Well, that's what I think. That was the previous suggestion, but that's exactly why the Akedat Yitzchak says that it's just not true. that if you don't have children, there's nothing for a woman to live for. That I don't think he literally, I don't think he took it literally either, as in I will literally cease to exist, but there'll be nothing, I had served no purpose in this world if I don't have children. And what he was saying is that's not the case. Rachel misunderstands what. Well, I think that that's part of the reason why a woman would feel that that was her only purpose in this world. And, you know, the rabbis actually often address this issue, probably because some of them didn't have children. And they say in many different cases that someone who teaches another Torah, it's as if he gave birth to him. The idea being that you're remembered by your students and your disciples if you're not fortunate enough to have children. So I think that that's part of the reason that they did that, was exactly that sense that, you know. Yes, the Lubavitcher Rebbe didn't have children is a good example. Exactly, yes. Yeah, I think that you're right in the sense that this is a crucial moment, because there is no more important life skill than figuring out how to deal with not getting things that you want, since that's a lot of life, right? In Kohelet, in the Midrash again, and here the Midrash on Kohelet, right? The rabbi's comments on the book of Kohelet. One of the rabbis says, no one dies with half of their wishes fulfilled. Now, that was thousands of years ago when people had fewer things to wish for, right? And he's saying no one dies with half of their wishes fulfilled. And that's the reality of human life. And if you can't come to some terms about unfulfilled wishes, then your life will always be miserable. And if Jacob is trying to teach that to Rachel, because he is presumably older than she is, then he's teaching her something invaluable. That's true. And us, for that matter. Yeah. Curious in what sense? She said she's kind of curious about this practice of cohabitating with maids. Yes, go ahead. So this is a fascinating subject. One second, and I think, if I'm not mistaken, it may not be in here, but I will take a look. I was actually had thought that this commentary had a review of this issue. Let me just say something about the issue, since I don't see it in here. But I'll bring more about it next time, because I know where there's some material on it. The status of the maidservant is something that's been the subject of a lot of research, in part because since we have literature from other societies around the time of the Bible, we can try to figure out what the status was. It seems as though the children of, first of all, no, she didn't have a choice, right? She serves the wife. Her children are the children of the husband and the wife, ultimately of the husband, and not her own children. That's what it seems like. But there were apparently different gradations. And so, for example, Hagar seems to have more status than Bilha and Zilpah. But it's a very strange and interesting thing, if you think about it, and most Jews don't think about it or are not aware of it, but that some of the tribes of Israel come from Bilha and Zilpah. They don't come from, right, Leah and Rachel. And it's very, you know, here's something that, I didn't hear what you said. Are they really Jewish? Right, exactly. you're from Yisachar or Zvulun? So for example, when we attack Muhammad, the Quran, Muhammad had all these wives. One of them was 7 years old or 8 years old. And people say, you know, how horrible it is. What we don't say is, of course, Jacob had a bunch of wives too. We don't know how old they were. And we consider them all the founding tribes of Israel. The truth is the ancient world, the medieval world, and the modern world, they're just different. And since we are celebrating, as I said at the opening of the class, not only Lincoln's 200th birthday, but also Darwin's 200th birthday, Darwin is a perfect example of the clash of worlds and the way in which people looked at what human beings are and where they came from and what they're constituted to be. So, yeah, I think that the whole maidservant question is a very interesting one, but it's clear for Rachel here that she sees his having a child with Bilha as completely her child and is more secure in a way than Sarah was with Hagar. So, for what it's worth, yeah. So it shows what I couldn't hear.
Consequences.
Yes.
That she becomes so vicious that she's willing for the hospital to sleep with her husband. And also, at the end, she loses her life. And maybe really God knew that if she becomes pregnant, that she's going to lose her life.
Yes. Right. Yeah, and envy in particular, you know, I've just been rereading a wonderful biography that I read many years ago and always wanted to reread of Samuel Johnson by W. Jackson Bate. And Samuel Johnson was, among other things, a moralist, and he had tremendous insight into human character. And I just read a section yesterday where he speaks about envy. And one of the things he says about envy is that it's one of the few emotions. He says loneliness and envy are actually two negative emotions that don't require anybody else to be around or you know, you don't need anyone except yourself to feel them or to interact with them. But he says envy is one emotion that both destroys the person who feels it and does nothing to the person who's the object of envy. He says, so it's not just, I mean, anger at someone almost always has an effect on that someone. But to envy someone, unless you take action, just the feeling of it, we envy people that we've never met, that we've never seen, that we never come in contact with, and it eats us up and does nothing to them. Absolutely nothing to them. Now that's an amazing realization, right? He was talking about how awful envy was, and he has what he thinks of as a solution to it. He says the solution to envy, in as much as there is a solution, is pride. Because, he said, there are two possibilities. Someone has a skill that you don't have, in which case you should admire it, or you think that you're actually better than they are, in which case your pride should not allow you to envy them. Which I thought was a wonderful way of thinking. I mean, he was quite remarkable, Johnson, but which I think is a wonderful way of thinking about it. So, I mean, that doesn't mean that it works, but at least it can be helpful at times because If someone says to you, just don't envy, that's not very helpful. But if someone gives you another way to think about it, that at least is a beginning of, I think here what Jacob is trying to do is a Hasidic strategy, which is to elevate your thoughts. That is, instead of directing them at a person, you direct them at God. Yeah. Right. It does. It gives them tremendous power over you, even though they don't. Right, exactly. And they could care less. Yeah.
What's that book you're
referring to? It's Samuel Johnson by W. Jackson Bate.
Bate?
B-A-T-E. Yeah. Johnson was actually the subject of the greatest biography in the English language, and probably the greatest biography ever written, by Boswell. That's quite a long biography, Boswell's biography of Johnson. But there have been actually two recent biographies that were written, too. There have been a lot of books about Johnson for reasons that maybe another time I'll go into. Johnson is worth a biography. He was a tortured, brilliant, wonderful man, really a remarkable human being. And in terms of people who overcame, he probably had Tourette's. He was born with diseases or got them very early on. He had all sorts of difficulties and he single-handedly, among other things, compiled the first great dictionary of the English language. But he was quite a remarkable man. In his conversation, Boswell followed him around basically and recorded his conversation. And he was one of the greatest conversationalists in history, and just spontaneously would say quite remarkable and beautiful and powerful things. So, but Bates is a great book. It's a great secondary biography of Johnson. So yeah. Well, my guess is he has lots of relations with them both.
Mm-hmm.
That would be my guess, because he wants kids, right? And he doesn't. How shall I put this delicately? From what I understand of the male sexual nature, love is not necessarily an indispensable accompaniment of having relations, although obviously it's a good thing. Yeah.
So do we not get the picture of Jacob and Rachel going to bed in the bedroom with behind closed doors in the queen size bed?
Yeah, no, you don't.
No, we don't get that picture.
No, it's a very, I mean, it's a, people lived in tents, you know, they didn't have private rooms and so on. And I would say that the one thing that I thought you were also going to add is he doesn't speak very nicely to Rachel, for someone he loves, right? Yeah. Right. I don't think it's a coincidence. I think actually in the ancient world, people didn't know that a man could be barren.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've read once or twice that the assumption was always that the woman was barren.
Yeah.
They didn't even realize that a man could be sterile.
I'm not talking about the assumption. The story says that Abraham couldn't have children,
right.
So he went to Hagar and had children.
And had children.
Jacob. So it's not just the assumption.
Well, I think it's because the woman giving birth is the miraculous thing. And the more you delay it, the more miraculous it becomes. So, thank you. So the fact that Abraham doesn't give birth until he's 100 years old, that's quite remarkable, but it's Sarah's giving birth at 99 that's really, you know, that's the great miracle. Saul Bellow had a kid at 83, okay? That's quite remarkable. If Mrs. Bellow had a kid at 83, that would have been miraculous. So the more you delay the woman's giving birth, I think the greater the sense of miracle. That's what I would guess.
Actually, my question is there any reason that when you talk about infertility, it has to do with the woman?
That's why. But that's what I'm saying, is that the reason, because in these stories, the way that you make the story remarkable is by that. That's the only thing that I can think of. There may be other reasons, but at least offhand, I can't think of one. Because a man being infertile and then having a child doesn't seem to be as miraculous as a woman not having a child and then having one later. Yeah. Right. If you think of her the way you think of Rebecca, because God came to Rebecca and said, there are two nations in your womb. So if she knew that this was her destiny and she was saying, I have to fulfill my destiny or I have no purpose here, then it would make sense. All right, next time, handmaidens and children and the tribes of Israel. Thanks.